I don't know who put up these rails, but I sure am glad. Well, good morning. It's great to see you. And add my words of congratulations to all you moms. It's not a put down of anybody who isn't a mom, but it's just a special time of recognition. And we appreciate all that you do and all that you have done. So have a great day. I'm a little nostalgic today. 43 years ago, this day, this Sunday, second Sunday in May, I stood here as the normal preacher. Jason's the normal preacher now. I guess that makes me the abnormal preacher this morning, so, which is probably closer to the truth than you know. But it is great to be here this morning, share some thoughts with you, and I appreciate Jason giving me the opportunity to do that. It's always a joy and in some ways a burden to know that you're speaking to people who love God and you want to say something meaningful to them, but not be too long in doing it. And so we'll try to keep it to a reasonable length this morning. You've seen all the ads, and I know you have, Blue Emu and the Ready Rocker, The Secret to a Better Back, Relief Factor, My Pillow, of course, Relaxium Sleep. You've seen all the ads, right? And 1,000 others just like it. And the Balance of Nature is the ubiquitous one. It's just everywhere. And along with those and some other snake oil type products out there, they always imply, sometimes it's written, sometimes it's explicitly stated. You know what I'm about to say, don't you? This will change your life. They're all going to change your life. And especially the ones like Balance of Nature and those other drugs are always in with this tagline: this product has not been evaluated by the FDA. It's not intended to diagnose, cure, or prevent any disease. So what's it intended to do? Make money for the manufacturer is my conclusion. This will change your life. Well, what does that imply? Well, it seems to imply to me that your life is a mess and it needs to be changed. Well, if you change it and some other product changes it, does it change back to what it was? I'm always curious about those sort of things. But if you just had the right cream or the right drug or the right pillow or whatever else is out there, then you would live an enormously productive, wonderful life. And what it's really saying to us is your pathetic little life, your sorry world, your pitiful existence would be enhanced immensely if you'd just embrace our product. Now, I have no doubt about it that renewal is needed. But it's not an external renewal that's needed. It's not a renewal of making us feel better. It's not some superficial revival. True revival is a revival of the heart. That's a realization that we are on this planet, created by God, living in a world that's broken. We've pushed God out of the schools. We've pretty much eliminated from public discourse. You can't have reasonable discussions with anything of religious nature with anybody, it seems, these days. And then we wonder why our world is a mess. Well, I can tell you why it's a mess. We have eliminated God from the equation. And if we're going to ever get back to a place where we can have some semblance of civilization that's grounded and rooted in that which is holy and righteous, it's going to come because of a revival. And here's the part that I think weighs on me as much as anything else. While we need a revival, and it's obvious to all of us, I think, that we recognize that it is a revival of the heart that's needed. It's not more laws. We have more laws on the books that are being implemented today anyway. It's not that we need more laws. It's what our hearts yearn for. Even if we aren't aware of it, our hearts yearn for that which is better, that which is good. And unfortunately, it's so apparent that we overlook it. We can't, as the proverb says, see the forest for the trees. Is anyone here a Sherlock Holmes fan? Anybody? Oh, good. I was hooked years ago on Sherlock Holmes, and I still love to read the stories. And there's a story, a famous story, of Holmes and Dr. Watson, who went out on a camping trip a few days out in the wilderness to kind of get away. They set up the tent and all the camping gear, and one evening as they lay there looking at the sky, Holmes broke the silence and asked, "Watson, look up. What did you see?" Well, if you know anything about Watson, you know he's always trying to impress Holmes. Watson replied, "I see thousands and thousands of stars." And Holmes said, "Well, what does that mean to you, Dr. Watson?" Well, he pondered for a moment this deep philosophical possibilities of the answer to that question. And he said, I suppose it means that the planets and the suns and the moon, the stars and the universe are all, we're blessed to be here on this world where we can induce theorems about crime and solving crimes. And I suppose that it means that we're really truly small in the eyes of God, and that we're blessed to be here. And I suppose that in the very least it means meteorologically, since that we're going to have nice weather. And then he pauses. "And when you see all those stars, what does it mean to you, Sherlock?" And Sherlock Holmes replied, "Well, it means to me that someone has stolen our tent." Sometimes that's the way it is with revival, with renewals. We get hung up on some path that we don't comprehend, words that we don't understand, and we look past the obvious. And we're looking for answers where there really aren't any answers. We're looking for some philosophical complexity, some way we can unravel everything and put it back in its right place. And we run right past the obvious. Because the obvious is, if there's going to be a revival in the world in which we live, within the state in which we live, within the community in which you live, if there's going to be a revival there, it starts here, with you, with me, with us, as a collective. A text read a moment ago, look at that again, Acts 5:27. "Having brought the apostles, they made them appear before the Sanhedrin," this sort of supreme court of the Jewish nation, "to be questioned by the high priest. 'We gave you strict orders not to teach in this name,' he said, 'yet you have filled Jerusalem with your teaching. And you are determined to make us guilty of this man's blood.'" Jesus, of course, is the reference. "Peter and the other apostles replied, 'We must obey God rather than men.'" If we're going to have a revival within our world, within our country, within our state, within our communities, we need to begin with a revival here. How can we expect the world to be changed if those of us who are planted in the world as change agents of the world aren't making any changes? Some of you probably are members of organizations like Shriners or Rotary Club or Lions Club, some other civic organization of that sort. And the one thread that seems to run through all of those that makes them desirable for our community is they don't exist for the club members. Now, they get benefits from being in the club, no doubt about that, but they're not there in their charter as a well, let's just make this good for us. And likewise, the theme that ought to set us apart as the Church of Jesus Christ, more than any other organization, more than any other institution in this world, is that we are not here, we don't exist solely for our benefit, for the sake of the members. Now, we get benefits from that. They're plentiful to see. But the point is, we have been planted here to make a difference in the world in which we live. As I observed churches inside and out over the last 50 years in ministries, I've conducted everything from church growth workshops, small group workshops, assimilation seminars from North Carolina to California. The one thing that I see that has been detrimental, more debilitating, and more damaging to anything for the cause of the kingdom of God is not false doctrine, although there's some out there. It's not the issue du jour. It's not some heretic that has infiltrated the church. The single most critical problem that I see affecting churches that are stagnant, not growing, holding back the advancement of the gospel, is the "what's in it for me" syndrome. "I don't like it" is the mantra. My needs are not being met. This church doesn't exist to meet your needs. It's here to meet the needs of the lost so they find Jesus. To some, the church is more like a cruise ship than it is a battleship. And that's just not right. If you're a member of the church here at Friendly Avenue, we're all in need of coming face to face with "someone stole the tent" moment. And so my question is, do we want to be a comfortable church or a Great Commission church? Well, Ron, does that mean you can't be comfortable and outreach oriented at the same time? That's what it means. Unless and until you become comfortable with reaching the lost, then we can do both. The church doesn't exist to perpetuate itself for the sake of just us. Small churches I've talked with, talked to, worked with over the years, so often many of them will tell you, if you were to survey the members, that they don't want to get too big. Why? Well, we want to stay small so we can stay strong. What does that mean? Who are you going to eliminate? You know, what is small? You know, most of our churches in the United States of our faith tradition are less than 100. Why is that? Well, we want to stay small so we can stay strong. Makes no sense to me. The commission of Jesus was, as you're going through the world, you make disciples. Now limit that to 75. Don't get overboard with this. Don't go crazy. I remember reading some time ago of a guy had been stranded on an island for years and finally was rescued. And the rescuers obviously wanted to know how he had survived and what he had been doing. He showed them a house that he had built out of the local lumber and trees and wood and so forth, and the church that he had built so he could worship there. And then there was another building over that had a cross on it that was another church. And they said, "What's going on with two churches?" He said, "Oh, that's the one over there that got too liberal and I left." Now, then, you know, that mindset makes me think that we're more like that than we would like to believe. Jenny and I love Washington, D.C., as well, at least as it used to be. Let me put it that way. We love the museums there. And if I was closer to D.C., you'd find me a lot of time in one of those museums, probably the Natural History Museum. I never get enough. They always have to drag me out of there. Here's a picture I took probably 40 years ago. If you've been there, you know it's in the lobby. As you walk in, that's one of the first things you see. It's a majestic animal, this elephant. Here's a picture that I took about 20 years later. You notice anything? It's the same guy. Nothing's changed. It's exactly like it was. And 20 years from now, unless something radical happens, it'll still be the same. When you walk in, that's going to confront you. Oh, I've seen way too many churches like that. 40 years, nothing's changed. And they become relics of some bygone era. That's not who we are. It's not who we're designed to be. This isn't a museum. We're not fossils, although some of us are getting old enough to qualify. The church exists to be salt of the earth. It exists to be fishers of men. It exists to be farmers who sow the seed. And then let God sort all the ones that don't belong. Everything we do should point us in that direction of reaching, touching the lives of people who are lost. Well, I guess they're going to be lost one day. No, you don't get it. It's not they're going to be lost. They are lost. And unless the Word of God intervenes, they're going to stay that way. In Mark chapter 1, verse 17, Jesus said, "Come follow me, and I'll make you pew packers." Wait a minute, am I misquoting? "Come and follow me, and I'll make you castle protectors." I misquoted again, right? You come follow me, and I'll make you, you got it, fishers of men. The researcher, George Barna, you've probably heard that name. He's out in California, does a lot of great work with polling churches and finding out what trends are and what's going, what's not going, and what's happening. And he investigated a number of churches that are just really growing. I don't mean adding one a year, but they are just really expanding. And he didn't talk about programs in his write-up. He didn't talk about fads. He didn't talk about gimmicks or these churches are just making better hamburgers for everybody to come and participate. He said growing churches are made up of, quote, members who are passionate about outreach. They saw every event in their lives and the church's life as a hand in bettering, enabling them to reach the lost. They looked at opportunities as a way to put God in the lives of people. God has brought us together in this place, in a collection of unique individuals of incredible gifts and talents, of extraordinary means. And He hasn't brought us together by accident. I don't believe that at all. He has assembled us as a fishing fleet to go into our community and into the world for Christ, to reach out to the world and do it intentionally. Intentionality. This Mark 1 text, "I'll make you fishers of men." Now, this intentional outreach is an interesting idea, and that's what I'll explore the last few minutes today. What does that mean? Intentionality. Well, one thing it means is we are intentional in our public proclamation that the gospel must be priority in the reaching out of to people in the name of Christ. The gospel is to be studied in our Bible classes. It's to be proclaimed in our worship services. It must be shared, however, outside of the confines of this building. We must obey God rather than men. Well, can fishing for men be a dangerous occupation? You better believe it. Over in Acts chapter 16, verse 20 and following, the text says, they brought them, sounds familiar, doesn't it? They brought them before the magistrates and said, these men are Jews and they're throwing our city into an uproar. See, they've moved out of Jerusalem now. They're fishing in some deeper waters. By advocating customs not lawful for us Romans to accept and practice, and the crowd joined in the attack against Paul and Silas, and the magistrates ordered them to be stripped and beaten, and after they had been severely flogged, they were thrown into prison, and the jailer was commanded to guard them carefully. Yeah, fishing is dangerous sometimes. Paul and Silas are imprisoned, and he writes to the church in Rome, these words from chapter 1, verse 16 and 17, the gospel is the power of God. Gospel is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, both Jews and Greeks. For the gospel of righteousness about God has been revealed. Programs don't save, activities don't save, worship centers don't save, unless they're all pointing to Jesus. Intentionality means a proclamation of the word, whatever form that takes, whatever avenue that takes. Intentionality also means that there's got to be crucial contact. The apostles were committed to reaching people in their homes, in public places. In Acts chapter 5 and verse 4, the text says, day after day in the temple, in the temple courts, day after day in the temple courts, and from house to house, they never stopped teaching about God. Pattern, example, I think that's a pretty good one. Contacts are vital for the growth of a church. It is important for preachers and elders and deacons, ministry leaders, members to be engaged intentionally. What does that look like, Ron? Well, are you talking about that dreaded DKC, that door knocking campaign? No. Now, if you wish to do that, more power to you. And if that's what you really enjoy doing, I'll get you a map. But you don't have to do that. Now, that works in a lot of places in this world where the gospel is being introduced in a new way. It works in Romania. It works in Dominican Republic. It works in Jamaica. But our culture has pretty much resisted that because it's been abused in a lot of instances. It means just we work smarter, not harder. Besides that being a cultural issue in our communities, there's another good reason that the vast majority of Christians don't have to do that, and that's because you don't need to do that. Every one of us have family members, friends, co-workers, neighbors who need to know more about Jesus. You don't have to, suck up your courage and knock on cold call on doors where some stranger will perhaps meet you in his boxers and throw beer in your face. That you don't have to do that. You have all sorts of contacts that'll be very courteous. They may not be responsive at first, but they at least will listen. Survey after survey. Here's one that this was been years ago that I read this. It stuck with me. Survey after survey of non-Christians, non-church, the unchurched, as we typically want to refer to them. The vast majority of them, when polled, said they would attend a service if somebody just asked them to. Did that just kind of blow you away? Maybe we just need to ask more. Now, if you exhaust your list of friends and neighbors, and even before that, be alert to people whose needs are there, who are hurting, struggling with life, and be a friend. Reach out. Touch them. Touch them with the gentle hand of the master. Why did people flock around Jesus? Because he cared about them. He listened to them. He understood their needs. If we were to understand, touch lives with that same hand of listening and caring for them, don't you know they too would respond to the Jesus that lives through us? A church that wants to grow numerically and better yet spiritually, contact's crucial. One more thing that I want to share with you, and that's enthusiastic evangelism. That's part of being intentional. I know that a lot of folks don't like the E word. Well, let me put it as plainly as I know how. Our commitment to evangelize the lost is non-negotiable. The apostles let it be known that they stood with God. We'll obey God. I don't care what the law says. We're going to obey God. Now, we're not lawless people. But Peter and the apostles said, we're going to obey God rather than men. I don't care what your law says. God takes precedence. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and verse 19 through 23, let me read that quickly. Though I'm free and belong to no man, I make myself a slave to everyone. You know the passage? To win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. Now, Paul's not fickle. He's not hypocritical. He's just saying, when I'm around the Jews, I accept their customs and live that way. To those who are under the law, I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law. So as to win those under the law. To those who are not having the law, I became like one not having the law, though I'm not free from God's law, but am under Christ's law. So as to win those not having the law. You begin to get an insight into Paul's thinking. To the weak, I became weak. To win the weak, I became all things to all men, that by all possible means I might save some. And I do all this for the sake of the gospel, that I may share in its blessings. Paul talked about becoming all things to all men, not just to fit in, but that somehow it might lead some to Christ. One recent poll showed that 93% of Americans have a Bible and only 12% read it. Might be a clue as to why we have problems. Less than one third did not know that God helps those who help themselves is not in the Bible, nor is cleanliness next to godliness. Less than half knew that Jonah was a book in the Bible. I wonder if Christians would score any higher. Melvin was a little boy in a Bible class, and it's about second grade, and his teacher asked, Melvin, who knocked down the walls of Jericho? Melvin said, I don't know, it wasn't me. Now the teacher was taken aback by that answer, so she had to talk to his dad. So she talked to his dad and told him what happened, and he said, well, Melvin's not a saint, but he's not a liar. If he said he didn't do it, he didn't do it. Now she's just aghast, you know, she's at the point of vapors. And so she goes to the elders and explains to them what happened. The elders went off in a side room for 20-30 minutes, came back and said, look, this is a good family. We have no reason to believe that Melvin's lying. Let's just get a contractor to fix it and we'll charge it to maintenance. Now, obviously, that's a fictional story, but I think it makes the point that maybe we're not as up to speed as we should be. The church that seeks to be evangelistic effectively has to come to grips with the fact that the generation that exists now has been called the new pagans. We're not a Christian nation. I'm not sure we've ever been one, but I'd like for us to lean more in that direction. And the way we do that, I believe, is we start here. Comfortable church or Great Commission church? Public proclamation. Crucial contacts. Enthusiastic evangelism. If we're united in our purpose, that we exist with a vision of God to reach the world with the gospel, then understand that outreach is not accidental, it's intentional. It's not a part-time job. It's not a hobby. It's a lifestyle. Outreach is not a side item. It's the main course. Outreach is not what we do. It's who we are. And if we lose sight of that, all we'll see are the stars and not be aware that someone has stolen our tent. One of the most impressive movies I've ever seen in my life, and I've seen a lot of them, is Schindler's List. If you've seen it, you know why. It opens in 1939. After the Nazis have defeated the Polish army, they moved into Krakow. The Jews have registered, and they're moved into a cramped ghetto. And we meet Oskar Schindler, a German industrialist who at first seems an unlikely hero. He's a womanizing, hard-drinking Nazi party member who rolls into town and views this as a great opportunity to get rich. By the 1943, however, after seeing the brutality of the Nazis and killing of Jewish men, women, and children, something happens to him. He changes. But he doesn't just change in his mind, he changes in his life. He begins saving the ones he can, doing whatever possible to get them out of harm's way. He's found out, he knows his time is about up, and at the end of the movie, Schindler breaks down devastated because he couldn't have saved more. And he realizes that his car could have saved 10 people. That his Nazi lapel badge could have been sold and probably have saved 2 more. One more, at least. Would that we had that much favor and fervor for the lost. My hope is there are some folks here today who are ready to make up their minds that they're no longer going to be keepers of the aquarium or administrators in a museum or custodian to the relics, but they want to be a comfortable church by being an outreach commission church. No longer keepers of the aquarium, but fishers, men. If you're ready to be intentional about your personal growth and about reaching the lost, Why not take the time to express that to the shepherds who are going to be in the back in the prayer room that meet with you and you can talk with privately, share your zeal and your enthusiasm or your repentance. Express your desire to be part of the next great adventure of this body at Friendly Avenue that has over the years done some incredible things, both on an individual level and as a body. But we can't stop there, can't be happy with where we are, moving to the next level of deep water fishing. It's really not an option, you see. It is not negotiable. We claim salvation is wonderful. If it is, then why are we keeping it to ourselves? I like the statement that I heard many years ago that we're just beggars telling other beggars where to find the bread of life that's available. If you need to respond to that, let the shepherds of this body help you work through that. Chad, would you come and lead us, please?